so chapter 14 of the book of Genesis says in verse 1, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela. All these together joined in the valley of Siddim, that is near the Dead Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled." Okay, these are actual places in Israel. They're not cities from Middle Earth, like you might think. There's four kings that are ruling from afar the land of Canaan. There's these four kings. They've joined together to make an alliance and rule over the cities of Canaan. That's the promised land. That's what one day will become Israel. So the first four names listed, that's the ones ruling, oppressing. Then you see a list of five kings after that that have rebelled against these four. Okay, that's the important part of what you need to know out of this. You do see some famous names in the rebelling kings. You see Sodom, you see Gomorrah. Don't get lost in the detail and the pronunciation of these things or understanding where they are. I'll explain kind of what happens as we go. But it says the four kings ruled over the land for 12 years. In the 13th year, these five kings rebelled. Okay, and this includes Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, important details for us to know so far. The ruling, oppressing four kings are actually from Babylon. Okay, they rule from afar, from the land of Babylon. The land of Shinar, that's actually where the Tower of Babel was. If you go back to Genesis chapter 11, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there, and they start building the Tower of Babel. If you remember that story, God confuses their language. They're trying to unite together, become powerful, so they no longer have a need for God. He confuses their language and scatters the people. Okay, he gives them a difference between each other. So that's where the nations start to form. People scatter and spread across the land. Different languages, different land boundaries, different nations are forming. Okay, this is where war really starts. This is where contention and conflict, this is where there starts to be contention between nations and countries, whether it's mentioned or not in the Bible up until now. But it's interesting, you see a group of four kings, they start to take aim back at this Tower of Babel concept. We can be strong, we can rule, we can gain more strength if we join together with others and rule in a combined fashion. Okay, so we see the nation starting to form alliance. And again, this is the first mention of war, the word war in the Bible here. Genesis has all sorts of starts and beginnings to it. In fact, the book of Genesis means the book of beginnings. Okay, so we see God create the first man, see the first marriage, we see the first child born, we see the first lie, the first sin, we see the first murder. What we're looking at here in concept is conflict and violence has gone from individual to individual or family to family. Now it's gone to nation to nation. It's now war and conflict on a larger scale. Violence is now growing across the earth. We see the escalation of violence from personal, from when Cain killed Abel, to national, this war between these nations that's mentioned here. Okay. Now, it's interesting to think about, we're one-third of the way into human history at this point. Most Bible timelines will show the world was created about 4,000 BC, give or take. Abram and his family, this story is happening about 2,000 BC. We know Jesus comes 2,000 later, and we know that we come 2,000 years after that. If you're halfway decent at math, you know that that's three sections of 2,000 years. So this is right one-third into human history. We're actually quite a ways in. But let's keep moving in the story. In the 14th year, verse 5, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and attacked. Now again, don't worry about the names. The Rephaim, the Zuzim, the Emim, and the Horites, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back, and they came to Kadesh, and they attacked the country of the Amalekites, also the Amorites, who dwelt in Tamar. In the 14th year, so these rebelling nations were free for an entire year, it would seem. In the 14th year, the four kings, they march from Babylon to Canaan. They come over, and they're going to put people in their place, seems to be the intention. Okay, the group of rebelling kings, they had freedom for an entire year until this happens in the 14th year. But we see this group of four ruling kings, they start on this path of destruction. And if you were to look at a map of Israel, they start in the northernmost part, and these places and peoples that they're taking out, one by one, they work their way south, and they just start doing battle, destroying cities and wiping people out. Okay, they move on a path called the King's Highway. This is a famous path. It's along the Jordan River. So they work one by one. They're wiping out these cities. And presumably these are cities and peoples that they did rule over. But these are not the rebelling ones. It would seem they're coming to crack down on the entire land. They're coming not necessarily just to deal with the rebels. They're coming to put people in their place. And archaeologists have uncovered these cities that are mentioned here. They've uncovered the places, and they've dated them to about 2000 BC, between 1800 and 2000 BC. Discovered artifacts and all the rest. One thing, and this is a total side note, but one thing about the Bible is it's backed up by history, by artifacts, by evidence, by things that happen, times and places and people. This is one support and one reason why we can believe the Bible is true. There's all sorts of evidence that corresponds to what these Bible stories say. These words don't mean anything to us, these names and these places. But people that have gone into depth and to dig and uncover these, that's a good thing. That's to discover that the Bible is actually true. This isn't made up history. This is real history. Okay. So the ruling kings, they come over. They work from north to south. They actually make their way past the rebelling cities, the five of them. They just keep going south. They circle around. They keep taking out more places, and they just circle around. It would seem they're taking out any ally that they could possibly have, these rebels. It would also seem that, again, they're showing their authority and their strength. By the time we get to the end of the paragraph we just got done reading, they come and camp in a place near the Dead Sea. Okay, this is where the real battle is going to take place. This is the bulk of our story that we're gonna get into. Okay, this is the Valley of Siddim near the Dead Sea. All right, let's keep going. Verse 8, the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, Zeboim, and the king of Bela, they went out, joined together in battle in the Valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer, Tidal, Amraphel, and Arioch. Four kings against five. This is the big battle. Okay. Now the Valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, all their provisions, and they went on their way. They also took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, all of his goods, and they departed. Okay, so here's the main battle. I know it took a few minutes to get to this, but this is the big battle. And we get virtually no fun details to think about and discuss. It's just a wipeout. There's not even appears to be much of a contest here. The opposing army comes in and they wipe out the rebelling armies. Okay, this is like Star Wars. I don't know if it's the middle of the good three trilogy movies or the Death Star and the bad guys. They just dominate for the entire. It's actually kind of like Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers as well. It's like not anything really happens, but it just mounts the suspense as to what is going to happen. But you've got the oppressors. They come in and they wipe out. They take all the goods. They wipe out the cities. And they're going to run away with the loot. And you get a detail at the end here that says Lot, Abram's brother's son, he also dwelt in Sodom. He was taken as well. Okay? So this is where the story actually starts to get interesting. Lot gets taken in the process because he was in Sodom. So we look back to chapter 13. If we just think about it for a minute, Lot had now made his way into Sodom. At the end of that chapter, he was near Sodom. He wasn't in it. He was just near it. Okay, Lot and Abraham go their separate ways. The land can't sustain the both of them. And they want to avoid further conflict between the two of them. So Lot settles down in the Jordan Valley. And this is a quote. This is from Genesis chapter 13, because it was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, and that's what the video quoted. It didn't quote, it was also like the land of Egypt. It was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. We get a glimpse into Lot's motives here. He sees maybe dollar signs, or at least prosperity or success, and he decides to go that way. He's got a lot of reasons why this is the place he wants to be. Looks good to his eyes. There's a lot of reasons why he would like to live there. He would have known the dangers of it, too, because in Genesis chapter 13, it talks about how the people of Sodom were evil. They were opposed to the Lord, sinning greatly against the Lord, is what it says. I thought the video did a great job of showing Abram's concern. When Lot says, I want to go there, he says, so be it. He lets him go, which we might get back to here in a minute. But Lot goes to the River Jordan's valley. Here we see he's now actually moved into the city. Whatever the sequence of events that led him there, apparently over time, he moved further and further towards the city of Sodom and finally into it. And again, this is a lot of what Pastor Jason discussed last month. It's important. Temptation will do this to us. Okay, it will lure us. Temptation into sin will cause us to move like a moth to the flame. It'll cause us to move toward sin. It'll lure us into a false sense of confidence, thinking that we're going to be strong enough to resist sin. It'll lure us into justifying our actions and say, these are practical things that really are for the best. It'll make us think that sin is going to be okay. It's enticing to our eyes, but it also tricks and deceives our minds and our hearts. Temptation will move us closer and closer to sin. Lot moved from the valley into the city where evil was happening. Sin will cause us to move from one place in our life where it's just a distant enticement to where we're right up against it, right next to it, having to decide whether we're going to engage in the sin itself. Sin will do this to us. It'll cause us to move. It'll cause us to be drawn. Temptation will cause it to be drawn towards sin. Almost always we're going to find ourselves in a situation where we're standing right next to a compromise that we're not going to be strong enough to resist. It's a foolish way to live, to allow sin to get you because the temptation that happened earlier, you didn't resist it at all. Okay, sin will get us when temptation draws us near. This is why couples who are dating shouldn't lie on the couch together watching movies late at night with no one else around. What do you think is going to happen? This is why couples who are dating shouldn't sleep in the same hotel room or at each other's house, even if it's in separate rooms. What do you think is going to happen? This is why you don't let your children play ball near the street. They know not to go in the street because you told them. However, when that ball is bouncing nearer and nearer, instinct or desire or whatever, it's going to cause them to eventually go after it. In the moment, they'll run after it. That's why you don't let them do that. This is why you don't allow yourself or your spouse to flirt with other people or have emotionally charged relationships with people of the opposite sex. You don't put yourself or someone you love into a spot where they can be tempted into sin. It's foolish to do so, and that's where Lot was. He was foolish. He was foolish to do this. Abraham was foolish for letting him. It was his failure. Now, Lot moved into harm's way. These four kings, they come through, they destroy the cities, including Sodom. They steal all the valuables, take prisoners, and in the process, Lot gets taken. Okay, and this is where Abraham actually gets involved. So we're more than halfway in, and he's just getting into the story. Verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner. And they were allies with Abraham. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night. He and his servants, they attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. All right, so here's the rescue. Lot's been taken away, and what happens is they get moved north. They've gone about 100 miles to the north, and they're just working their way back home. They're going back to Babylon. So they got all the money, all the loot, all the cattle. They even took prisoners, men, women, and children as captives, including Lot. One of Lot's servants apparently escapes from the battle or from death. He runs to Abraham, and he tells him what happened. Okay, it says here, Abraham immediately gathers 300 men, and he starts in pursuit. Okay, this tells us a few things about Abraham. For one, he's powerful and wealthy. He has his own personal army of 300 people. It says they were all born into his household. It says they were trained. He apparently knew how to train men for military conflict or combat. So we know he's powerful and he's wealthy. We also know that he was prepared. He had a large enough family, a large enough group with him, enough people that he was responsible for, where he took measures to make sure that he was prepared to protect them if needed. And here we see him jump into action when that's true. We also see he's a patient and self-controlled man. Okay, he has the power and ability to physically conquer. He could do it by force if he wanted to, but as of yet, he's not wielded that power. He's moving around the promised land. He's settling in Hebron. Okay, he didn't move into the land and take it by force. He's waiting on God's timing, God's direction. Apparently, God's not told him to do this. Okay, take it by force. Sounds like he might have been able to do some damage if he wanted. So he's a patient and self-controlled man. Also, he's a gracious man. He has allies. Lists these three guys that are his allies. He's moved into their land. They've accepted him as one of their neighbors or friends. He has a good enough rapport with them. They have his respect and his favor that they're actually going to go with him on this quest. He's a gracious man. He's well thought of. He's well respected. Okay, so we can learn some things about Abram just from what the details are here in this place. But it says he pursues them as far north as Dan. So this is 100 miles to the north. This is a 3 to 4 day pursuit. That's assuming you can walk about 25 miles a day. Sasha and I were in Chicago a week or two ago. We made it 17 in a day. Okay. So assuming that they walk faster than we do, they'll be okay. 100 mile pursuit, 3 to 4 days. This is not a fast thing. This is not an easy journey. This is not like it just in the afternoon, let's go put up a big effort and then come back. This is pursuit, not knowing whether we're going to catch them. When he kept going. Finally, he catches up to them. It says he divides his army into two groups, and they make this surprise attack at night. Okay, it's a strategic attack. We don't really know how big the army of the four kings was. They were big enough to come and destroy cities. They were big enough to defeat a combined army of five cities. But we don't really know how much bigger than Abraham's army they are. And so attacking at night, it likely caused some confusion, and it certainly put Abram's opponents on the run. What does this story remind you of? Years later, hundreds of years later, in fact, Gideon comes along, and he's this weak guy. He's afraid. He's uncertain of how to fight. He gathers together this huge army. God whittles it down to about 300 people. They go and attack at night, and a surprise attack causes some confusion, some chaos, and it puts the enemies on the run. It certainly reminds you of that story. It says here in verse 15, Abraham pursued his enemies north of Damascus. So even after he caught up to him, he goes up to 40, 50 miles further. The army's on the run, and he just keeps after them. This is until he recovers all the people, all the goods, everything that was taken, everything that he was after to try and recover. And so the battle continues a couple more days even after the initial time where they catch up. So Abram's forces win the battle. Okay, everyone gets rescued. Lot gets rescued. The other captives from Sodom. It's interesting to think about, but Abraham didn't just rescue his nephew and their family. He actually saved these wicked and evil people from Sodom. In the process, he helps them get free from being taken captive by the Babylonians. It says he starts to head back for home, and that's the end of what we read. Verse 16, he brought back his brother Lot, his goods, and as well as the women and the people. Now, before we move on in the story, I just want to talk for a minute. Life is a battle. You know, we're talking about a physical battle that happened in the Old Testament. We're talking about Abraham, one of the patriarchs of the faith. We may not have those obviously, you know, heroic moments like Abraham. This is the kind of stuff we daydream about, you know? Saving the day, getting into the action. You guys know it's true, especially you guys. This is the kind of stuff you daydream about. We may not have those heroic moments, but there certainly will be a fight. There certainly will be things that we'll have to fight for in life. Anybody that has married, has a family, anybody that has responsibility, anybody that's set themselves up to try and do something good or even great, you have to fight for this stuff. You actually have to put up a fight to make sure you do it God's way, to make sure that you love and protect and help the people that you're responsible for. You fight to protect the ones you love. You stand up for what you believe in. You endure conflict, even if it's unwanted, even if it's inconvenient. Here is pretty inconvenient for Abraham, wasn't it? You put up a fight to actually live out the faith that you say you believe in. Life is a battle. You can't stand there and passively accept it to happen to you. You actually have to make choices, you have to take actions, and you have to stay committed to it. You have to continue onward in it. Life is a battle. The moment you rest or decide, I don't want to go any further, that's a moment where you're going to start to see things happen in your life that aren't exactly what you hoped they were. This is where you're going to start to see a loss of desire, a loss of peace, a loss of joy, a loss of purpose, a loss of mission. Sometimes this stuff works in a circular fashion where you feel like, I'm excited today, I'm going to go out and engage in the fight, and that just excites you more. And it's so it perpetuates itself. But honestly, the real fight, the real test is the days where you wake up and you don't feel like it. You need to continue to pursue God even when you don't feel like it. Life is a battle. Now, these are moments of deciding for us. A lot of the times, this is internal battles. These are against our own thoughts and desires. This is against the temptation to sin. This is against the desire to give up, to stop, to look for something simpler, easier, less contentious, more pleasing to my flesh, more worldly successful. Sometimes it's conflicts with our families. Okay? Sometimes it's a fight with our family. Sometimes it's a fight for our family. But certainly this involves family. Other times it will mean stepping out into unknown situations in order to love, help, and protect people who are helpless. And that's what we see Abraham do here. Importantly, we need to arm ourselves with the right attitude on this. That's for sure. The Bible tells us a lot of things about how to approach life at large, life in general, to be ready for this fight, the battle. It says, fight the good fight of faith. It says, do everything you can to stand firm. Be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Walk worthy of the calling to which you were called. Act like men. Bear one another's burdens. Strive for holiness, without which no one will see God. Put on the mind of Christ. Take care of your families. Love your wife. Respect your husband. There's all sorts of things. The Bible gives us pretty clear instructions. This is how you need to think. This is how you need to approach life. And this is how you need to do it. You have to have the right attitude before you're ever going to be successful in carrying it out. You got to have God's Spirit empowering you to do this. You have to have some desire to please God in order to look to His Spirit to empower you to do this. But we can put the right thoughts in our head, the right attitude, so that we actually have a fighting chance to be engaged in the battle and to succeed. Many of us live with an attitude that everything will work out. Everything will just work out. We hope for the best. We wait for things to fix themselves. We put up no fight at all, or at least only a minimal one. This was certainly my default position for the first 25 years of my life. In the last 12, I've learned a little bit of how to fight. If I'm being honest with you, standing here today, it's still a default position for me. I have to fight against this attitude, everything will just work out, to even be in the fight. And for me, this is often step one. things don't often just work out. Sometimes they do, and that's the problem. It gives you false hope that maybe they will. It's not that we need to rush out and force our timing, force our will and our agenda on a situation to make something happen. But certainly, we can't just stand back and passively hope for things to sort themselves out. Not every time. This means seeking God first and foremost. That's part of the fight. This means taking the actions God is leading you into. That's the second part of the fight. But waiting for things to just sort of work out is not going to be the answer. Okay? Life will leave you behind if you do that. So, questions for us. Are you ready for the fight when it comes? Okay. Are you willing to fight? Are you equipped to fight? And do you fight the right battles? Okay. Abraham was ready. He jumped right into the fray. He met the fight straight on. He did what God wanted him to do, and he went out and rescued his nephew Lot. Now, the second half of the story here is going to get into more of the worship side of what we're discussing here. Verse 17 says, the king of Sodom. Now, Abraham's going to start moving back towards his home. That's kind of where we're going physically in the story. The king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheba, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the God Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be the God of Abram, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered you, has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tithe of all. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you say, I have made Abram rich, except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eskel, and Mamre. Those are his allies. Let them take their portion. All right, so again, Abraham starts to move back towards home. He's got all the prisoners rescued. He's got all the, you know, the goods, the loot, the bounty, and he's moving back towards his home and their homes. And so this would be south down towards the Dead Sea. Along the way, it says two kings come out to meet him. Okay, so in the beginning, we had a group of four kings that were sort of the oppressors, five kings that were the rebellion against them, and now we see these two kings come out to meet him. And this place is called the Valley of the Kings. This is actually near Jerusalem. You see, one of them is the king of Salem. Most people believe that Salem is short for Jerusalem. It means peace, and most people think the king of Salem was the king of Jerusalem. But let's look at these two kings real quick. Firstly, the king of Sodom. He was kind of one of the instigators of this saga. He's been there from the beginning. We don't really know what happened. He didn't fall into a tar pit. I think that makes sense. He probably fled to the mountains and otherwise hid after the battle was over. Okay, but here we see him traveling north a good amount, 2 or 3 days' journey, to meet Abram. He wants his stuff back, or his people back, I guess. The other king is the king of Salem. Okay, this guy's not been involved in the story so far. Okay, it says his name is Melchizedek. He's a priest of God. He's the king of Salem. His name, Melchizedek, means the king of righteousness. Okay, there's a duality between these two kings. There's quite a difference. There's a opposition. There's a wide chasm between what these two kings represent and who they are. They each come out to meet Abraham, but they each come out and offer him something completely different. Okay, you see the king of Sodom, he's exactly what you'd expect him to be. He comes from a vile place. He comes from Mordor. All right? No, he comes from Sodom. Genesis 13:13. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. They had a reputation for this. Imagine if that was the city you were in. Okay? And he's the one ruling over it. Well, he offers no thanks, or blessing to Abraham. It's clear God is not part of his life. He's a sinner against God. He's working apart from God. He instead has demands for Abraham. Okay, he wants his people back, the ones that Abraham had rescued. The only thing he offers is to try to pay Abraham off. Okay, he says, you can keep the money and the goods for yourself, but give me the people back. He didn't even say please. This is a business transaction. Both he and Abraham can get exactly what they want, and he's presumptuous about what Abraham will want. But both he and Abraham can get exactly what they want. Thank you for your service. Here's the amount I'm willing to pay you. I will certainly compensate you fairly. You can benefit from your efforts. Here's our success. Okay? Uncork the champagne. Celebrate together. That's the king of Sodom. On the other end of the spectrum is this Melchizedek, king of Salem. Okay, there's nothing we can really expect of him. He just comes out of nowhere. There's no precedent, really, for what to expect from a guy like this. This is the first time any priest or priesthood is mentioned in the Bible. The Levitical priests, the priests of the Old Testament, the law, the Ten Commandments, Moses, you know, Charlton Heston, that comes later, much later, okay? There's no priest yet. And so this guy's a priest of God, sort of under whose credentials we don't know, sort of under what covenant we don't know. But this guy shows up out of nowhere, a king of righteousness and a priest of God Most High. Abraham realizes quickly, this guy worships the same God as me. He recognizes it right away. This guy follows the same God as me. He also realizes this guy's more important than me. And we see the detail that he tithed to Melchizedek. He saw him as a king that was above him and a priest that he was to respect and be led by in worship. And so he tithes to God through Melchizedek. It says, Melchizedek offers Abraham bread and wine. This would be to him, all of his army, all of the captives. He gives them food, gives them sustenance, he gives them wine to celebrate. What does this remind you of? Bread and wine. Okay, it's a no-brainer. He gives Abraham a blessing. He comes out not demanding something from Abraham. He comes out to bless him. And even more importantly, he comes out to worship God, to offer this praise to God. This is a worship session between the two of them. And they do both get exactly what they want. All praise to God. He did this. He delivered you from your enemies. He deserves the credit. Let's celebrate him. And that's the moment they have between the two of them. This is quite a difference between these two kings that come out to meet Abram. He had a choice to make in this. Okay, he could collect more wealth. He could collect more prosperity. He sort of had it in his possession. This is the spoils of war. He sort of had it, and he could have kept it. Or he can give his wealth and prosperity away. He can use it to bless, to give to the Lord, to worship God through his wealth, not to keep it and hoard it for himself. Another way to put it, he could receive an earthly reward for his efforts, or he could receive a heavenly one. And he chooses the heavenly one. He does exactly what you hope he would do. He doesn't hesitate. He doesn't ponder over the two choices here between these two offers that were made. He accepts the blessing from Melchizedek. He worships and praises God. Okay? And then he says he offers a tithe. And this is worship. He gives a tenth of everything he had to the Lord through Melchizedek. Okay. He rejects the king of Sodom's offer, and it says he doesn't want him or anybody else to ever think, this guy made me rich. He doesn't ever want anybody to be confused about why Abraham is prosperous. He wants everybody to know it's through God. It's through the Lord's blessing. That's what defines me. That's what makes me rich and prosperous. In his case, it was physical and material wealth. But certainly, use that as something of a spiritual concept. Who do you want to make you rich? Or what do you allow to make you rich? Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. He rejects the king of Sodom's offer at earthly fame and earthly reward. We're going to have the same choice to make. Each and every one of us. This is sort of our entrance into life, really. We basically have two offers. We can live for the world, or we can live for the kingdom of God. We can seek to collect things for our own self, for our own, you know, appraisal, for our own sort of core wealth and value, and keep all that to ourselves. Or we can seek to give to God everything that he deserves. Instead of trying to hoard, we can seek to give. And that starts with praise. That starts with worship. Okay, we have the same choice as Abram. Which are you choosing? And back to this question, who are you allowing to make you rich? Or what are you allowing to make you rich? Is it the world or is it God? Do you find your value through your job title? Do you find your wealth through your talent and ability? Maybe even through your report card? Maybe it's through your bank account? Maybe it's through your popularity? What gives you value? Okay, where are you receiving wealth from? A lot of us will make choices that are subtle, but they'll tell a big story. Where we work, the hours we work, our desire when we seek employment, are we looking for a high dollar per hour? We seek the highest, even if that means a compromise in our working hours. A lot of us make subtle choices that do tell the story as to where we're finding worth, where we're receiving wealth. God's giving us his entire self. God gives us value. He gives us peace with him. He gives us purpose and meaning. He gives us the opportunity to seek heavenly treasure. Are you seeking that, or are you seeking the worldly stuff? Also, Abraham vowed to give God his full due. It said a little bit in the middle of the passage, I raised my hand to God and promised I wouldn't do it. He made a vow to the Lord. Many of us have made the same promise. In this room today, many of us have said, yep, I'm giving God the best of who I am, what I have, time, talent, all the rest. The question is, will you follow through with that? Are you following through with that? Are you keeping your word no matter how lucrative the world's offers are that come in? Okay. Abraham vowed to give God his full due. How are you doing at that one? Well, this is quite a story. Again, one of Abraham's finer moments. He hasn't always been the case. And we know that there's some failures coming up. We know there's some failures in his past. He's been a liar. He's been a coward. Here he's the hero. Okay? And I think everybody loves a good hero story. I think we like to think that people will remember us for our finer moments. We hope they don't remember us for our failures, you know? What can we learn from this? Apart from what we've already talked about, how do we look at a story like this and learn, observe, take away some practical things? Do we learn how to be like Abraham? How to be brave and heroic? How to equip our household? How to fight when the time comes? We've talked about some of those things. How to protect your family? How much harder it is to win your family back once you've let them go off and live in the world? Okay. We could talk about that all day. How to worship God. How to tithe to God. Who Melchizedek was and how he points us ahead to Christ. That's a whole year-long sermon series. What I want to look at just in closing is some of the key characters here. I think this will help us set our attitude, set our outlook on the story. First of all, we all start out like Lot. If you want to think, who am I in this story? Certainly, you are Lot or you've been Lot. Okay? We all start out as Lot, controlled by sin and temptation, moving, living, being in the world, taken captive by sin, needing rescue. Okay? Once we are rescued, we'll find out later in the story, often we're drawn back into sin, into temptation, which Lot will be. Guess where he moves after he comes home? We all start out as Lot. In this story, Abram is like Jesus. He's the older brother who leaves his home. He goes on a rescue mission for his captured younger brother. Through outward weakness, he defeats the great enemy with a surprise attack. The younger brother is rescued out of captivity, made free to start a new life. Okay, this is where we come from. This should keep us humble. We need rescue. Sin does have us held captive. We need to be rescued out of our sin. And Jesus will do that for us. He'll come find us. He says he comes after us. We all start out as Lot, needing to be rescued. Secondly, we all can become Abram. We can all choose to be Abram. We can take on an attitude of godliness. We can choose to bravely fight for what we believe in. Okay, we can ready ourselves for battle. We can protect our families. We can help the helpless. We can reject the world's offer to make us rich. We can worship God and look to Him as our value. We can choose to be Abram. Okay? He was a changed man. He believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. Okay? He's the father of faith. Though he often failed, sometimes he didn't trust God, at least not with his choices. He did believe God, and God gave him righteousness for that. And that's what's coming in chapter 15. He lived for God. He fought for God. When he messed up, he made things right, and he continued onward. He desired to live for a heavenly kingdom, not an earthly one. Okay. Question for us, will you choose that path of life? Abram had to make an actual choice. Each one of us in the room, individually, will I love and serve God? Will I believe God's promises? Do I think life with him is better than life in the world? So we can choose to be Abram. And then thirdly, we have a priest and a king. This guy Melchizedek shows up to meet Abram out of nowhere. The Bible comments on him in two other places. I think it's Psalm 110 and then Hebrews 5, 6, and 7, something like that. It's a mysterious guy. The book of Hebrews actually says he's got no genealogy that tells us when and where he was born. He has no date of death or gravestone that says he actually died ever. And so in that, he's representative of a priesthood that goes on forever. He's not Jesus. Some people think that. He's not Jesus, but he pointed the way to Jesus. He was a type of the Messiah to come. And it says he's a priest and he's a king. And he comes out to meet Abraham. He offers Abraham communion, bread and wine. And he points Abraham's attention to God. So if Abraham ever thought he was alone in this pursuit of God, and I think there were moments where he did, he was wrong. There was a king in the land to come out and lead him. There was a priest to mediate between him and God. We have that same thing. And we know ours much better than we know who this Melchizedek is. We know that Jesus is both king and priest. Okay, he's sitting at God's right hand mediating for us. The reason why we can have confidence before God, we can come to the throne of God boldly to receive grace and mercy when we need it. It's because Jesus has already went through all of the pain, all of the punishment, all of the suffering that we would for our own sins, or that we will. And if we actually look to him as priest and king, we can receive peace with God. This king of peace, very similar to Jesus being the prince of peace, this Melchizedek. We have a priest and a king. We have the same thing. Okay, it's not up to our ability to fight bravely or choose wisely in order to be right with God. We're told to do these things, fight bravely, choose wisely, but they aren't the things that are required for us to be accepted by God or acceptable to God. Jesus is that. If we put our trust in him, if we give him our life, if we submit ourselves to his kingship and trust in his priesthood, we're made right with God. We receive peace with God, forgiveness of our sins. We don't got to worry about doing this whole thing alone anymore. He's always there. He'll never leave us. He'll never forsake us. We have a priest, just like Melchizedek, coming out to meet us that allows us access to God. So, realize that we are Lot. That's where we start. Choose to be like Abraham. It's an option that we have. And trust that our high priest is real. That he's there. That he offers blessing and communion and peace. Okay? Let's pray.